like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Robert Clark, an award-winning photographer for National Geographic and other major magazines. He's shot more than 30 stories for that magazine, including more than a dozen covers. Clark has just published a new book, Feathers, Displays of Brilliant Plumage, which offers a zoomed-in, eye-popping look at a vast array of bird feathers, exploring their differences in architecture, color, function, as well as the evolution of some feathers from the days of the dinosaur. It's really quite an inventive and remarkable book, and it carries a preface by New York Times science writer Carl Zimmer as well. We'll find out about Feathers, Displays of Brilliant Plumage, and the ideas behind this distinctive book, and more when I speak with Robert Clark in just a moment here on Talking Animals. Later in the program, I'll speak briefly with Carol Baskin, founder and CEO of Big Cat Rescue, who will offer some observations about the incident Friday in which a tiger killed his keeper at the Palm Beach Zoo. Right now, though, let's speak with Robert with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Robert Clark to Talking Animals. Good morning, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us this morning on Talking Animals.
My pleasure.
Yeah, and congratulations on Feathers, Displays of Brilliant Plumage, a remarkable book by any measure, and I'm eager to discuss the book, and we will, of course, in a moment or two. But you have a pretty compelling story pre-Feathers, so I'd like to address some of that first. Where do you mark the true beginning of your photography career? I mean, for example, many moons ago, you were a newspaper photographer at the Philadelphia Inquirer, but I'm going to guess you maybe would place the true start somewhere else.
Yeah, I grew up in western Kansas, a city called Hays, Kansas, and, you know, I was very interested in photography, but I didn't really know how to go about it in a lot of ways. But my brother was the sports editor of the local newspaper, so most of my early work was based in and around sports photography, and there was a really good photographer at the newspaper, and he taught me a lot of things, and my brother had high standards, so, you know, it all kind of sprung from that situation.
And then, obviously, you trace some sort of path to end up at in the Inquirer. Now, for many folks, especially back in the day, shooting for a major newspaper kind of signals a photographer's pretty professional pinnacle and that they've really arrived, but I sort of have this hunch that you may consider the moment you actually left the Inquirer to constitute a more momentous sort of portion of your career.
Well, you know, I was very lucky to work at the Philadelphia Inquirer. I had an internship there, which they don't do for college students anymore, very, very often anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was four Pulitzer Prize winning photographers there, and it was an amazing place to work. So it was kind of graduate school for me in a lot of ways. And it was a great place. But I ended up leaving the Philadelphia Inquirer to work on a book called Friday Night Lights, which a lot of people know about high school football in Western Texas. And, you know, the book was on the bestsellers list for around 50 weeks. And that was my first work that was published in Sports Illustrated. So there was a lot of opportunity that came from leaving and taking the chance.
Right. Well, that's, I guess, partly what I was referring to is it seemed like, again, that shooting at the choir back then, especially, again, with colleagues like that, is not something that someone would leave without a lot of, I would think, trepidation. And but the fact that you did leave now, saying, okay, well, yeah, it was for Friday Night Lights, is easy to say now, okay, of course, that. Why wouldn't you do that? But back then, I would think that would be a pretty pretty risky, scary move.
Yeah, it was a bit of a chance, you know, to be honest.
So, yeah.
You know, it wasn't a sure thing. So,
for sure.
The writer of Friday Night Lights was very well known and had won a Pulitzer as a reporter at the Inquirer. So, you know, there was a lot of talent there. But for me, it really harkened back to the time when I was shooting high school sports. And I understood the subject matter, and I was always more interested in pictures about winning or losing than action. And I think that was really applicable to the way the book was intended. It worked out really well.
For sure.
I've all the pictures for Bissinger's books, and it developed a long relationship there.
And just as an aside, I'd be curious what you thought of ultimately of both the film and then the TV series, both made obviously based on the book.
I did some photography on the set of the movie, and I think the movie was good. There's little things that people don't know. One of the main characters is a guy, Booby Miles, and he's actually in the movie in one of the climactic scenes, and they kind of zoom past him to the character who was actually playing, the actor who was playing Booby Miles. Books have so much more depth, and,
sure,
you know, it was about the boom-bust cycle of oil and racism and classism and things like that, which is really hard to show in a 90-minute film.
Yeah, yeah. And then did you have a different set of feelings about the TV series?
Actually, kind of funny. I've never watched an episode.
Oh, okay.
And it wasn't intentional. I think I just got, busy, distracted. And now that it's on, Netflix and things like that, I can actually just kind of watch it from season to season and have a better commitment to it, I guess.
Right.
Trying to catch it every Tuesday or whenever it was on the schedule.
Sure, I gotcha. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Robert Clark, an award-winning photographer whose work has appeared extensively in National Geographic, and has just published a book called Feathers, Displays of Brilliant Plumage. If you'd like to ask Robert a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So as I just mentioned a second ago, Robert, you're closely identified with National Geographic, having shot more than, I think, 30 stories for the magazine, including, a dozen or more covers. If I'm not mistaken, it was work on some National Geographic pieces that spurred your interest, or further maybe spurred your interest in feathers and the sort of deep exploration of feathers that you present in your new book. What were those pieces, and how did they kind of further kind of galvanize your interest in this realm?
Well, I've actually done around 40, 42 stories now, and there's several just kind of waiting to be published.
So. Wow. Okay. Well, I'm updating this as we speak. Well, then I think I might even I could have I, could I have gotten that from the book jacket? That couldn't be that far behind. Maybe it's somewhere else.
Jacket has a larger number, but regardless,
yeah,
the Geographic has been incredibly good to me. I moved to New York after Friday Night Lights and learned how to do some advertising, still photography, and then the kind of stories, and I was official because then the stories I started doing for Geographic are science and paleontology, archaeology, subjects like that, which, you're dealing with dinosaurs and the natural world. You're talking about things that are 140 million years old, 90 million years old, 65 million years old. So you're kind of getting into the subject matter of evolutionary biology. And the feathers article was initially a article about the history of feathers. And in Liaoning province in China, they were finding all these birds that were really well preserved, and you can actually see the feather structure. So it was kind of dealing with paleontology to begin with, and some of the scientists who were working on structural matters of the feather fossils, and that way they could identify what the colors of these feathers were. I worked on this story, The Curious History of Feathers, and, it was quite interesting because you learn about the things from the past, and then you're dealing with, the things that are remnants of that, like sexual selection, flight feathers, secondary flight feathers, and then the structural beauty and just the way feathers are made is an amazing thing. They're one of the most complicated things in nature.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm interested in so many things about your interest, starting with as you're describing this. I'd be curious just to back up just more generally for a sec. Did you sort of gravitate to the National Geographic? I mean, obviously it has an amazing reputation for just astonishing photography, so I would see that on that level. But I mean, were you already interested in science and paleontology and the kind of things that you ended up shooting for the magazine, or did that develop as you kind of stepped into the National Geographic world?
You know, more of a development as I got there. I wanted to work for the magazine. You know, I wanted to be the photographer who went away for 4 months and, you know, shot whatever he felt like shooting. And there's a lot of people who wanted those jobs.
Yeah.
I had a bunch of them who were famous and really well known. So it wasn't, you know, I wasn't going to be the first one chosen for those kinds of jobs. Although I get some beautiful stories now that have a lot of landscapes and cultural aspects to them. But, you know, I'm from Kansas and I had an uncle who always said that you have to ride the horse in the direction it's going. And the first story I had was an archaeology story about a shipwreck that they found in the Gulf of Mexico. The next one was about Patagonia dinosaur hunters. So, you know, I started getting those early, and I was, you know, successful at those stories. And, you know, success brings success, I think. And, you know, I developed a relationship with one of the photo editors, Kurt Mutchler, and I think we've done 14 stories together. And
Wow. And
he's been very, very generous about suggesting me for a lot of the stories that he's been responsible for.
That's great. Because, yeah, I mean, as you're starting to describe the thing with the China bird and curious history of feathers, I'm thinking, you know, that's sort of a far cry from high school football and somewhere out in the hinterlands of Texas. So I just wondered, yeah, if you had kind of pursued that path, or that path opened up for you and then you sort of just traveled down it, which it sounds like indeed was the case.
You know, it's funny, but I don't think they're that dissimilar in the sense that it's all about telling a story and
sure.
It's all about good photography. And that's always been kind of my motivation. And, you know, I'm interested in almost anything photographic. So, you know, so...
And also, if I'm not mistaken, I think you had a fascination with birds that kind of dates back on some level to when you were a kid.
Yeah, I mean, Western Kansas isn't the you know, the hotbed of, like, you know, bears and deer and wildlife like that, but they have some of the best pheasant hunting and quail hunting in the world, and those birds are around. And we were also close to the migratory path of the of some of the cranes that come back and forth from Central America to Canada. So sandhill cranes and it's a place called Cheyenne Bottoms where they've stopped there for eons. So that was not far from me, and I'd gone over there once or twice and just always fascinated with those birds.
Yeah. So you had that sort of early interest in birds generally that you were exposed to growing up in Kansas. And then again, you on these shoots for National Geographic and you developed this interest. Still, it's one thing to say, you know, I sure find bird feathers fascinating. It's another to say, I find bird feathers so fascinating that I'm going to do a book on it. Can you kind of trace that path for me?
You know, it's I was given the assignment by Geographic. And
yeah.
When we do an assignment, we do a lot of research. And I ended up shooting pictures of the fossils and then shooting pictures of the feathers. And I wanted to shoot the feathers pretty much exactly the same. So the visual difference of what you saw was the feather. And about the location I shot them in, I could shoot them in Germany or China or Kansas or a number of the different places I photographed, whether I was in a museum or in a person's feather collection. So, which is surprising that there are a lot of people with feather collections.
Yeah.
But I was able to focus on the fact of making them photographs the same, so the real difference was the feathers themselves, showing the variety and the complexity of different aspects of feathers.
Mm-hmm. Sort of zeroing in on that technique for the National Geographic piece, is that where you started to think, hey, I could really expand this, and this the way I'm approaching this actually would merit becoming a book?
Well, you know, kind of the best, you know, I end up owning all the pictures that I shoot for Geographic at the end of the day. And one of the best advertisements for my work is a magazine that has 8 to 10, 12 million circulation. I've done a lot of evolutionary biology work, and I'd done a story about Charles Darwin. I did a story about a guy named Alfred Russel Wallace, who wrote Darwin a letter and said, hey, I have this idea about natural selection, you know, being the vehicle that makes evolution work. And Darwin was like, oh my God, I've been thinking about that for 25 years since I got off the trip around the world on the Beagle. And that combination of all those stories, I had put together a book dummy about just evolution in general. And at a Paris book show, the editors from Chronicle Books saw the proposal, and then they thought, well, you know, we could just take one section of it, this section about feathers, and I think we could do a beautiful book. And I was a little like, yeah, I think that would be interesting and good. But it's become so such a perfectly clear idea that you know, it was Bridget Watson Payne at Chronicle, and then Rachel Hiles, who handled the production and design of the book, that have made it. They've helped so much and made it very special.
And it really is. I mean, it's a gorgeous book, obviously, with just stunning images. Once they said, hey, you know what, let's do this, and you were sort of down, starting to head in that direction, how did you determine either a structure, or were there some sort of guiding principles for what you would include? Obviously, you already had a lot of images that you'd shot from those National Geographic pieces, but, I mean, you know, obviously, you're not going to also include every single feather that exists. So,
right.
I mean, how did you shape it?
You know, I found a bunch of other feathers to photograph, and I did that work. And then we, you know, I think we put together like 180 feathers, and then we started to look at the differences in the feathers and what we were trying to show. You know, there's downy feathers that keep them warm. There's feathers for birds that aren't capable of flight, you know, ostriches and different birds like that. So I kind of looked at the mix of feathers. There's five different types of feathers. We included all those types. There's some feathers that are more, they're less evolved, I guess you should say, than the ones that are than other feathers. You looked at feathers like the birds of paradise and about the sexual selection, because a lot of feathers have different purposes. We included a picture of an owl feather, which is, you know, not the most interesting looking. It's brown and white, but it has a different shape to it, which allows the owl to fly silently. So, you know, it's fascinating to see that's an amazing part of its behavior comes from, you know, just feather development.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you're really, over the course of the book, you're looking at sort of the design or architecture. You're looking at, yeah, if they have one or more specific kind of functions. And I guess in a tip of the hat to Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace, a lot of it is also the evolution of those feathers. And you see some of those images, sort of reptilian things and stuff that I guess really harks all the way back to the day of the dinosaur, which is pretty astounding.
Yeah, I mean, it was important to me that in the book that we talk about the connection to the past and to the study of evolutionary biology, because, you know, obviously I'm a big fan of the, you know, people call it a theory. It's like, well, they call gravity a theory too, but it's a reality. You know, I think it's undeniably the way that the planet evolved. So, you know, that being said, I wanted to include some of that, but I also wanted it to be beautiful. And because, you know, as most people think about feathers, they think about beauty and, you know, design. And, you know, a lot of the things are beautiful, but yet they evolved because they had a certain purpose. And that was important to show purpose.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, I mean, unless someone's like a real birder, I don't know how often someone is inclined to think about feathers or their purposes. But then something like this book, and it's like, oh my God, this is a whole sort of revelation, really, of all the things that really do distinguish feathers. And an ostrich versus a macaw or whatever, I mean, that's a pretty significant difference. And,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And you recognize that. But until you really see how their feathers compare and some of the incredible detail and why a certain bird's feathers is thick or has a certain kind of design and why others is all about the colors and trying to attract a mate or whatever it might be. I mean, you really think, wow, I should have been thinking more about feathers before this.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things to think about. I've got another project that's in the works about a broader subject of evolution. And, you know, there's 480,000 kinds of beetles that have been described, I believe, and or not described, but they some scientists, you know, they know there's about 480,000 kinds of beetles, but a lot of scientists think that there's more like a million different species of beetles. And it's amazing to compare one beetle to the next and just the different shape of their bodies and what those shapes mean and how they affect they were affected by what they needed to do to, you know, pass their genetic code forward, which is kind of the point to all evolutionary change. And you know, I was able to photograph Darwin's finches, the actual birds that he collected in the Galapagos. And a lot of these birds will live on the same, they'll live on the same cactus. Some of them have large beaks. Some of them have small beaks. The ones with the large beak open the big seeds. The ones with the small beaks open the smaller seeds. And the two never, they never interrelate as in terms of mating. So the big beak finches, you know, have chicks with the other big beak finches. And it's just fascinating that they have this very close behavior on the same cactus, but yet it's separated. So they're actually different species of birds on the same cactus. So it's fascinating.
And it sounds like, again, you've really become very much a sort of a deep Darwinian guy, because I think there's so much about Darwin that just people maybe generally have in their head. But, I mean, there's this whole thing that some people may or may not recall immediately, where he really tried to put some of his principles into practice with breeding pigeons and seeing what he could muster through those principles.
He was very interested in proving it to himself. And, you know, had Alfred Russel Wallace never written him that letter, he may have just been content to publish on The Origin of Species after his death. His wife was religious and wealthy. They were the heirs to the Wedgwood China fortune, and which was a very successful business in England at that time. And so he didn't really have to work. So he was, you know, kind of a gentleman beetle collector, if you will. And he never thought that he had the right to talk about some of these things until he became an expert on one species. So he is the person who studied barnacles, and a lot of the taxonomy and the definition of different aspects, structural aspects and behavioral aspects of barnacles is still Darwin's the first reference on a lot of that.
Yeah, isn't it wild when you think when this was and what kind of access he did and of course did not have to research, to technology, to other ways to sort of verify or further delve into things, and how much of what he wrote and thought then totally holds up now?
You know, it's interesting. The first story I worked on was called Was Darwin Wrong? You know, and then, you know, the first word in the article was no. And,
yeah.
You know, that's won a National Magazine award for the writer, David Quammen, who's one of the top, you know, science writers in the world. You know, and Carl Zimmer is amazing, too. He worked with me on the evolution of feather story for Geographic. So I was able to get to know him better and convince him to write the opening essay for my book.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. And yeah. Some people listening might know him from writing the weekly Matter column in the New York Times. Really great science writer. But anyways, go ahead.
He's great. He's got a bunch of books. He wrote a book called Parasite Rex, which is, you know, an awesome book and really informative about how parasites evolved and came to be. And you know, very accessible writer, yet just, you know, I learn a lot whenever I read anything from Carl. You know, so the thing about Darwin that was interesting was that he started out trying to fit things into this box that included, you know, creationism in a sense. And, you know, his grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, was a big thinker and had one of the leading, you know, theories about evolutionary behavior, you know, 45 years before Charles Darwin had a more of a accurate idea of things. And he was also, like I said, he was kind of a gentleman guy. He didn't have to study or anything like that. And at that point, the class system in England, you know, he would write to other scientists and they would gladly share with him, which isn't the same in science today. I mean, there's so much, you know, recognition and profit and things like and considerations like that in science today that a lot of people don't share information. You see that in the competition, the original competition for a Zika vaccine.
Yeah.
And then now they've all decided to cooperate because it's such a horrendous thing, and they just want to solve the problem. He actually wrote Alfred Russel Wallace, and they were correspondents, and Wallace lived in Bali, Borneo, Java, that area, and was sending specimens back to Darwin. You know, there was a different level of cooperation in that time than there is now.
Yeah, that's quite a level incredible cooperation and just a really intriguing collaboration, really, between mm-hmm. those two. So
absolutely.
Yeah. Again, this is Talking Animals with Duncan Strauss. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Robert Clark, an award-winning photographer for National Geographic and other major magazines. He's just published a new book, Feathers, Displays of Brilliant Plumage. If you have any thoughts or comments on feathers, birds, photography, or other items, we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So, Rob, which feather images in the book have stayed with you the most, and why?
You know, for me, it's hard to get past some of the birds of paradise feathers, the red bird of paradise and the Wilson's bird of paradise. They have such precise, they are used for sexual selection, and there's another one that it looks like a green lollipop, and that's on the tail of one of the birds of paradise, and it's just hanging out there kind of bouncing around as part of its mating ritual.
And I can tell you right off the bat that that's page 34, because that was one of the ones that really stuck out for me. The green one that does sort of, yeah, I guess resemble that you mentioned, a lollipop, and it's so striking. Were there others? I mean, you know, I don't know if this starts to be like, you know, this is kind of like my children, I love them all. I mean, they're all like just really compelling, but some, I imagine, with your kind of eye and just with your kind of interest, there might be some that just you really felt more profoundly affected by.
I love and it all comes down to me, like, kind of successful composition and photography. And I think page 82 and 83, the ostrich feather is really quite lovely. And there's no color to it. It's white, and it tends to, but it's a composition for me on that and the way the lighting works. And, you know, the golden-breasted starling on page 79 is beautiful. And
yeah.
I love some of the pictures that have wings, like a superb starling is a beautiful iridescence to its structure. And you know, that's one of the things I learned, which I didn't realize, but I learned on this story, was there's two kinds of color. There's pigmentary color and structural color. And, paint, the dye in our pan, things like that have pigmentary color. But structural color is actually part of the structure of, as the name would suggest, is part of the structure of things like butterflies, bird wings. And what it does is when the shape of the wing or the butterfly changes relationship to the light source, to the sun most likely, and or to my eye, then that's when that iridescence happens. That's when a butterfly's wing becomes greenish instead of blue, and that's when feathers change color based on how they're reflecting light. It transmits light back at a different angle, so it changes the color.
Well, no, that's what I mean. I mean, once you really step into this book, it's mesmerizing, and it really does kind of reset your thinking. And again, some of the things are just, some of these you could be flipping through someone's coffee table book and not know that it's feathers necessarily. Like another thing that I remember really just being totally grabbed by was the great Angus, and it's like a two page thing, and it's like, wow, okay, I know I'm reading a book called Feathers, so I know, of course, that this is feathers, but you look at it and you just think, I mean, it's just a visual feast, but it could be any number.
I think that's the great Argus that you're talking about, right? It has the big blue right through it.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
The thing about that is, and some evolutionary biologists have told me, and others don't necessarily think or know that it's true, but it's pretty drab brown bird until it lifts its wing up, and then there's this color patch below it. And feathers oftentimes signal to other birds the health of the individual whose feathers they're looking at. And that is a part of sexual selection, and it lifts its arm. And some of the design pattern on that is similar to the seeds that the bird eats. And they think it's a representation of that, and that females look at that and go, oh, I'm going to go with the guy with the most seed, because of that pattern, and then the health of the feathers overall. Every feather has a reason.
Yeah.
It's not just, sometimes it's beauty, which is about sexual selection. Sometimes it's quilting, which is about warmth. There's primary flight feathers, secondary flight feathers, sorts of things. And it, you know, I love learning things like this in depth.
For sure. Well, the Great Argus certainly has attracted me. I don't know if that's going to make the Great Argus nervous, but that is just like one stunning thing. We're just sort of near, I thought we had a call, but they got tired of holding. Sorry, I was going to bring a call in, but we're just sort of nearing the end of our time, Robert. But what do you, who do you consider the audience for this book? It sounds like really, as we've talked to you, you're just so driven by your passion and the stories that you shot, and then luckily this publisher said, hey, this, I think we have really something here if we just focus on the feathers. So, you know, is it the kind of thing where you and they just felt like this is so kind of distinctive, and again, the images are so captivating that this will just find an audience over time?
Yeah, I think that I think the beauty is the thing that was the driving force in this, and the fact that everybody can kind of relate to feathers, and I think that it makes it accessible. Yet when you start thinking about some of the purposes of them, it's quite informative. And I think that, you know, feathers are everywhere. People see them on the ground or they see birds flying. I think the attraction to birds flying and the freedom that represents is one of the reasons that they decided to do this book, and I'm you know, super happy they decided to do it, just because it works. I think it works really well, I'm happy to have been part of the project. It's really I was kind of the genesis of the project, but to have somebody else have this vision and put it together in a volume like this is great, because you know, it's 100 and how many pages is it? It's 176 pages, which you aren't going to get 176 pages in the National Geographic about feathers.
Yeah.
So it gave a lot more real estate to the pictures that I had already shot and to some of the new things. So it's a really nice, festival yet beautiful book.
For sure. And that last sort of note, never get that kind of space in National Geographic. I'd be curious, you know, what's your view of the state of photography and journalism? I mean, obviously National Geographic, still remarkable, still, of course, a supporter of you and a fan of you and gives you a lot of work. But a good friend who's a photographer just told me over the weekend when I saw her out in California that Sports Illustrated just had laid off its remaining photographers. Sports Illustrated,
yeah.
Which, of course, you mentioned earlier that you had worked there. I didn't realize that. That just seems like just the ultimate wallop in terms of where things are headed.
You know, I mean, the magazine is called Illustrated.
Yeah, exactly.
So it presents a little bit of a problem. And I think that, you know, Sports Illustrated was the Bible for me growing up. It was, you know, very much where I wanted my career to end up and to go. And then I kind of changed my mind. But I'm friends with a lot of the people who work for Sports Illustrated, the photographers. And I think one of the most interesting things is that they made their mark doing game stories, like analytic game stories and beautiful photography. And as you know, the coverage got better on from the announcing and the photography point of view for television, and then the digital age, you know, they can post stories right away. I mean, the New York Times or whoever posts stories, you know, from the first half, the second half, the third half, and
sure,
or the third quarter rather, and so it's hard to compete with that. And I think that what they needed to do was to focus more on the feature and the profiles and give you the behind-the-scenes look at sports in general. And, you know, it's hard to compete with a company like ESPN, who has this good, really great magazine, and it has a very talented group of people working there. And they also have a TV show that they can tie into and that actually makes a lot of money and can support the magazine. So, you know, I'll tell you, it's a changing landscape when everybody thinks they're a photographer. And, I still think that great photography is driven by, you know, certain amount of control over the technique, but also by a story narrative.
Yeah.
So I tell young photographers all the time, I say that a point of view or a reason for doing things is more important than a camera, because you can borrow a camera, but you can't borrow a point of view. You know, that's kind of my thoughts on the issue.
Gotcha. Well, we've been speaking with Robert Clark. His new book, again, is Feathers, Displays of Brilliant Plumage. His website is robertclark.com. And when I posted something about this on Facebook, Robert, someone commented on that they're a big Instagram follower, love your work, and there and elsewhere. So you have fans scattered around. So thanks, Robert, once again for joining us today on Talking Animals. Good luck with the book.
Thanks so much. I appreciate having the conversation with you.
Me too. Thanks again. Bye-bye. In a few moments, I'll chat briefly with Big Cat Rescue founder Carol Baskin, seeking her perspective on the tragic incident of Friday at the Palm Beach Zoo in which a tiger killed his keeper. Right now, though, it's time to step into the comedy corner. People seem to really enjoy the extended conversation I had last week with Paula Poundstone, but we didn't have time to hear any of her stand-up. We're rectifying that right now. This is Paula Poundstone with a piece called Cats Puff Up in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals.
You know what I can't figure out? All my cats are indoor cats, and some of them are out-and-out fat and lazy cats. And I don't know why they puff up when they fight with each other. You know, I know, you know, they say, oh, cats puff up so they look bigger to their adversaries. But first of all, my cats all know each other. You know what I mean? They don't really believe for a moment that one of them got really big. I mean, cats know about puffing up. That did they think it was a trick only they knew? And the other cat actually just got bigger in that moment? That doesn't make any sense. And it seems to me it must take a lot of energy to puff up. I would think that they would just have a meeting, and one day my head fat lazy cat would just turn to the others and say, look, from now on, let's nobody puff up. We already know about puffing up. We're not fooling anybody. If you puff up and I puff up, we're the same anyways. Tell you what, once a day I'm going to grab each of you with my front paws and kick at you with my back paws, and you just take it. I tell you what, cats are no help whatsoever in terms of security, you know. Cats get the exact same look on their face for a big giant moth as they do for an axe murderer. And they go, great, I'm either going to get a hole in my head or my sweater.
All right, that was Paula Poundstone with a piece called Cats Puff Up, taken from her CD, I Heart Jokes. Let's move now into our conversation with Carol Baskin. She's the founder and CEO of Big Cat Rescue, the Tampa nonprofit educational sanctuary that houses abused and abandoned big cats. So let's welcome Carol Baskin back to Talking Animals. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals.
My pleasure.
Let's talk about what happened Friday at the West Palm Zoo. And I was actually in California when it happened. It was a huge story nationally, obviously, because it immediately hit the airwaves there. So give me your thoughts on sort of what happened, what it means, what the implications are, especially now there's debates still raging about everything from tranquilizing the tiger as opposed to taking more drastic action, which then slowed down the paramedics' ability to rescue the keeper. And there's other things that have, of course, being discussed and debated as well. So what are your thoughts on it?
I tell you, every time I hear something like that, it just makes me heartsick because we have so many big cats at Big Cat Rescue, and I'm always so concerned that somebody is going to let their guard down, and it could be them. So it just, you know, as much as it pains me that it happened to somebody that I don't know, it really scares me to know that it could happen to someone that I do know.
Well, one thing that I saw and read after I'd contacted you about doing this was a sort of an essay or blog post about this and kind of what it's sort of two main conclusions that you tend to draw when something like this happens. Can you articulate those?
I believe there are only two reasons why zookeepers are killed by tigers or any other big cat. Number one, there's been a failure in the safety measures to keep the tigers and the zookeepers apart, like a broken latch or a door that didn't shut all the way or something that has rusted to the point where it failed. And the other reason is that the zookeeper doesn't understand their relationship with the tiger or with any other big cat. They think that they are a tiger whisperer, that the cat loves them, that they have this unique bond that's going to keep them safe. And so they overcome the measures that have been put into place to keep them from being hurt or killed with that false sense of security that they have imagined.
And that, I think, is such a huge point. And again, obviously, we feel horribly for the woman who was killed Friday. Friday, but I couldn't help noticing, even just in the brief sort of pieces that made their way to just coverage in California of this, and then certainly when I got back, how much was made of her sort of being considered by herself and or others a tiger whisperer. And it just seems like that is just fraught with peril.
I shudder when I hear people say stupid things like that, that they're a tiger whisperer. Tigers are tigers, and they have their own agenda, which does not include being held captive by people. And they're certainly not inclined to try and please us. They may be solicitous of our attention because they're in a cage, and they're having to beg for everything they get, every scrap of food, every bit of concern or care for their well-being. They're having to beg for because they can't be in control of their environment. So the minute that they have that control, they're going to exercise it.
Yeah, and then I guess part of the thing is, and I think I noted this in when we exchanged emails, I mean, every so often there's someone, and again, it's a little different in a captive animal setting, but it's not that different, where people get labeled, again, by themselves often, but sometimes by others, as some sort of whisperer. And if it's a tiger or a lion or a bear, something like that, I get people that post these videos on my timeline and say, hey, you should have them on the show. And I think, I don't even want them on my timeline because, because the misimpression is so powerful. It's like, hey, isn't that great? And maybe one day I or someone else who has a real kind of connection with animals could do that too. And I'm just thinking, okay, there's another tragedy that's about to unfold. We don't know when, but it surely will.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are so many of these people that have been lauded on television as being lion whisperers or as having that unique bond with an animal. And people see that. They see that little snapshot of a person cuddling a big cat or working with a big cat or showing dominance in some way and think, I want to do that too. And what they don't realize is that those people are usually covered in bites and scratches and often will end up being killed or mauled to the point of not being able to have a normal life any longer. But because the masses see those images, they want to duplicate that experience. They want to be like that. And so they go out and they pay to have their pictures made with cubs, and they go out and they get themselves into dangerous situations because they just have no clue what the truth is when it comes to these big cats. It's just irresponsible to show or share those kinds of images of people having close proximity to big cats.
For sure. Well, circling back then to the zoo situation itself, because one of the things that, I mean, as a part of the debate in the aftermath of this tragedy was, A, how much time there was between when apparently the attack happened and when paramedics were called. And then the recording of the 911 call was released, and boy, whoever it is that was calling from the zoo did not want to give any information, even though there was a complete emergency at hand. And again, perhaps at that point still, maybe not, but potentially a woman's life hung in the balance, and really vague and sort of giving the dispatcher the runaround. I thought, you got to be kidding me. This is so striking. And you'd think, God forbid something like this would happen, that a zoo would have a protocol in place.
Yeah, I heard that 911 call, and I was just mortified that there was so much of an effort, it seemed, to hide what was happening, because I'm sure the person who was calling for 911's help understood that those calls would be released to the public and didn't want to have that end up being publicized. But I think they made it even worse by trying to hide it.
Well, because in real time, you hear the person sort of saying, hey, I know this call's being recorded. And it's like, oh my goodness, okay, why is that your concern right now? I mean, Is there something, any larger lesson that we can take from this, Carol?
Well, you know how I feel about this. I don't think big cats belong in cages, period.
Right.
And I think a lot of zoos are figuring out that there are some animals that just cannot be given a humane existence in captivity. They're finding that out about elephants. They're finding that out about orcas. And I think tigers and lions, the other, you know, huge carnivores who roam hundreds of square miles, those types of animals can never be safely or humanely kept in cages. And so I'm really sorry that this happened, but I think it helped shed a light on the fact that we need to rethink the whole concept of keeping wild animals in captivity.
Well, unfortunately, that might be the perfect point at which to leave this for now. So thank you. We've been speaking with Carol Baskin, again, CEO and founder of Big Cat Rescue right here in Tampa. And thanks for your insights and comments today, Carol. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Duncan.
Bye-bye. Coming up at 11 on WMNF, it's Rob Lori and Radioactivity rolling in the noon hour. Constitutes a full 2 hours of interviews, phone calls, news, and more with contributions from members of the stellar WMNF staff, including, of course, Everyday Ethics with Craig Kopp. Meanwhile, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a Talking Animals t-shirt. Right now, let's hit a few animal news and announcements, including coming up this very weekend, Rescue Dogs, a special family film that has a social message, opens in Palm Harbor at Movie Co. Theaters, Palm Harbor. Harbor 10, this Friday, April 22nd, and Suncoast Animal League will be holding a special contest for its red carpet premiere on this Friday, the 22nd, and there's all kinds of other cool things, including live adoption events that are happening both Friday and Saturday. More information at rescuedogsmovie.com. It's one more reminder that the Champions, the documentary about the pit bulls rescued from the Michael Vick dogfighting ring, is scheduled to screen Monday, May 2nd, AMC West Shore 14. And Darcy Dennett, the director of that film, on a few weeks back. You can go to tugg.com and search for the Tampa screening for more information on how you can get tickets. That's Monday, May 2nd at the AMC West Shore 7:30 screening. Also, join Florida Voices for Animals and Animal Coalition of Tampa at Snapper's Grill and Comedy Club, Palm Harbor, Thursday, May 5th at 6 p.m. for an evening of laughs. Headliner comic DC Benny and feature act Steve Netta. All proceeds benefit animals. For more information and to reserve tickets, go to floridavoicesforanimals.org. The annual Puppy Love Benefit by the good folks at Pet Pal Animal Shelter is coming up. That's going to be May 14th, 6 to 10 p.m. at the Historic Coliseum, 535 4th Avenue North, St. Pete. You can find out more information by going to petpalanimalshelter.com. And just want to quickly call attention to the remarkable piece that Nicholas Kristof wrote in the New York Times on Sunday, within a day or so being announced as a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize. This was headlined Animal Cruelty or the Price of Dinner. Search that out if you didn't have a chance to see it. Right now, though, it's Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. Time to proceed to Name That Animal Tune. This is a giveaway, but please only participate if you haven't won something from WMNF in the last 90 days. There'll be a prize, a Talking Animals t-shirt, to the first person who calls 813-239-9663, correct identifies this animal song. One hint, this artist was recently inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Caused quite a ruckus afterward. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. We will take the guesses that are rolling in now off the air, because we have reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Lori is up next with 2 hours or thereabouts, or what amounts to it at least, of Radioactivity. We'll be back next Wednesday with another edition of the show. Please go to talkinganimals.net. This is WMNF Tampa. Thank you.